my second question is like, how do you manage all this thing? All these intellectual models?
Yeah, right? You know, this is one of the kind of the secret sauces of a company like Microsoft. Make sure that our folks really understand the benefit and value of diversity. We need to be diverse because you've got to have that kind of all these different perspectives and that ability to be able to speak in the customers, not just physical, literal language. Salespeople generally are not productive in the office, generally speaking, unless there's some compelling benefit for them. You know, usually when I was a sales director, I tried to model this behavior too.
Welcome to the RH Podcast. We talk about business, software, and everything in between. Visit our website at www.recursive.house.
Hello.
Hello.
This is Pierre Halspess. He's a former business analyst, consultant, senior solutions architect, and right now he is the sales activation director for Microsoft. So welcome.
Welcome. It's good to be here.
I mean, that's great. You know, at least you're not here so well, you know, that's always a good start. Well, I have a few questions for you, if you don't mind. I'm going to do a little bit of a softball thing here. In the beginning.
Then do the hard questions come afterwards? Is this going to be like the TikTok CEO this week getting in front of Congress?
Saw that. Poor guy. He was really trying his hardest. And they were like, no, you're not the best ever. And near the end of that, they said he was really trying to answer their questions. And then near the end, you're like, he didn't answer a single question. And he's like, I really kind of did. But, you know, it's a tough, he's been put there to, I don't know if he's been put there to fail or not, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see how that whole, good luck trying to shut a company down that basically does what every other IT social media company does. There was a lot of stupid questions and the way that very, like, just I want a yes or no answer, which is really a trap because they're under oath and, you know, so he, you know, you're coached to avoid, you know, that kind of thing and then mischaracterizing, you know, do you have the ability to spy on American citizens? It's like, well, like you did with the other ones, you know, like kind of a thing. It's really interesting. And it's always interesting. And then it's like, you know, I've been in that meeting. You like, I've been in this guy's shoes. Anybody in IT has been in that kind of like, you guys have no idea how this works technically. And so you're asking super technical questions, like the one senator who was like, this was my business and all of that. And it's like,
No, fair enough. And because, you know, you've had experience in technical sales and a lot of people just understand salespeople as salespeople. And you're, I guess, in a way, a perfect if you were in those shoes, you'd probably be the perfect person to answer because you actually understand the technical side really well and the sales side really well. I guess one big thing is like from your experience, what it really is the difference between technical sales and sales.
Yeah. So sometimes it's impossible for a company to completely evaluate, you know, you think about it like, you know, marriage or dating or something like that. You cannot completely evaluate that experience until you sign the, you know, on the paper, on the dotted line and move in together and share finances. And, you know, you truly get into, you know, a partnership where you have equal risk. And some of the stuff is the same way. When the bigger the company gets, the more proof is required because they can't fully evaluate the solution until, you know, until they are married to it, right? So it becomes very difficult to, you know, sell, when you think about selling something into a factory floor, you know, where you've got a 24/7 operation, you know, if I'm going to say, hey, we're going to make your, you know, machine operators 5% more efficient in something like automotive where they've squeezed every, you know, literally the physical motion of people and time studies and all this. And we're coming in and making some sort of claim that we can, you know, really improve productivity. Well, you know, in order to evaluate that, you actually have to put the software in, you have to interrupt production. You know, there's lots of risk that's associated with that. You may be absolutely accurate in that some of your customers have had that. You can point to testimonials, but until it gets evaluated, you know, the proof of that is very hard to find. So, you know, that's where it becomes very interesting, you know, so to speak, and very kind of complicated and, you know, a little more sophisticated requirements than just straight up, you know, hey, selling techniques that, you know, you learn as a salesperson when, you know, if I'm selling at, you know, an individual, let's say I walk into a Best Buy or a retail store and I've got, you know, mom and dad buying a computer for the kid. And it's that experience of selling is very straight up, you know, features, benefits type of discussion. And, you know, hopefully you catch them on the right day and the price is right. And you apply some, you know, sales techniques in terms of, you know, asking questions, finding the right thing, you know, doing your discovery work and then going in for the close, you know, or, you know, would you like it on Tuesday or Wednesday or, you know, the blue one or the green one? You have all these different kind of techniques that, you know, help you as a salesperson, let's say, gain an advantage or maintain some sort of control in the sales process. But once you get into, you know, that kind of corporate side, like a company like Microsoft, that's a big difference at any level. You know, when we have, you know, a WinWire is like, hey, we just sold this deal to, you know, look at any one of these giant customers that are, you know, customers of Microsoft, and we make a big announcement, you know, I don't know why they call it a WinWire, but it's a traditional name for an internal announcement. Hey, we just won this deal with Walmart. And so you'll see a WinWire and it gets like, it's an email that gets sent out and it's kind of a brag. Like, hey, the team did great. Well, you look at the team and it's never just one person. Literally, there's 50 people that are involved, you know, in this process. It's a large amount of individuals that have to work together to coordinate, you know, for that customer. Everybody's got different skill sets. And because there is all of those buyers at the customer, you know, there's, you know, security specialists and database analysts and, you know, all the people that are involved from the technical side. And then there's also, you know, business organizational people that help address things like risk and what is the business value and what's the support plan after. And so it's and the license, and there's negotiation with pricing and, you know, how the pricing and costing, you know, is going to be and over a period of time, too. That's the other part, which is really interesting. It's never just, you know, it's $14 million. It's like it's $1 million this year for X amount of users. Then, you know, 6 months later, we're going to add, you know, there's a growth plan, so to speak, for those transactions. So it's way more complicated than most people would think. And it's kind of shocking. Actually, when I came over to Microsoft to see it to this degree, it's really amazing. And so that, you know, that's the part of it that's really fun at the same time. Like it's a team effort. It's such a teamwork kind of component. And you need to have a mindset of, you know, you're working together as a group and you have to have really good collaboration tools and, you know, to really align your messaging so that you kind of are able to cause a lot of doubt into the customer about what your intention are and what, you know, who is you, you know, from the customer. You know, it's a bunch of people. And at the end of the day, it's not that monolithic group. It's a bunch of individuals that are, you know, making connections and whatnot. So that's the fun part, actually, of what we do from a sales kind of perspective. So
one of the, for me, something that was, that's interesting is, I guess there's several things, but how, you know, what is there a point you can say that companies feel that now is the time for us to make that jump or take that risk? It's hard to sort of have an individual point. It's probably multiple points over a period of time among different groups, and each group has different points within that where they kind of justify it and sort of trying to, you know, slug that along and coordinate and make sure that you're always going forward and not backwards. But is there is a point where maybe there's an accumulation of these things where it's almost inevitable for that come, you know, what is the inflection where it's only going, you know, the trust is going up, not down.
That's the art of a lot of what's being done. And what you're doing is ultimately, you know, nobody's going to buy anything just because it's got cool features, you know, in our business anymore. Like that's not usually what it is. And a lot of research has been done. Like if we look at things, something like CRM systems, for example, just generically, like CRM is such a highly competitive, mature business, right? In fact, our Microsoft Dynamics CRM system is turning 20 years old this year. Many of us that started our career on that platform, you know, in the CRM consulting space, you know, we've been doing this for 20 years now. And I think we were about 2 or 3 years behind Salesforce at the time. So, you know, this is not a startup kind of business anyway. This is a, you know, these are billion-dollar businesses now at this point. So super mature. Lots of research has been done about effectiveness of those like solutions. Do they raise sales? Do they, you know, reduce cost and improves, you know, do they deliver on the promise, you know, and what are the ingredients of that? And often what it is not actually the technology or the software specifically. It has a lot more to do with the program that you surround that solution with. We kind of know this really when you think about it. Like if you look at the cars as a market, like pretty much all the cars can go 100 miles an hour. Like they can all, you know, get in them, go fast. Like it's not a question of that, really. Features, functions, that type of stuff. Like there's nuances in that, of course, you know, companies leapfrog over each other in terms of tech and abilities and stuff like that. But a lot of it in terms of success is really ultimately about delivering on the promise, not just, you know, the specific application or tech that's being done. It's sooner able to use those functions. So what I'm trying to say is, you know, it comes down to business value, knowing when that business value is able to be realized. And, you know, that's the art of this discussion often is trying to figure out what that motion, you know, is for the customer and not just, you know, hey, we got this tool and there you go and just buy it. And if the customer's not ready to do it, then you could have all the greatest value and close a sale if you were really good and go, whoo-hoo, aren't we awesome? If the customer, like this is the interesting part about the business we're in now, it's a subscription. So it's not a one-time thing anymore. Like we have, thing has to continue to deliver value over and over again. Every month, a customer is voting whether we're successful or not. Their dollars, we are very tied into that metric of monthly active users, you know, customers, and what's the delta between actual users and paid users. And so if customer has lots of, oh, we closed the sale, that's awesome. But we don't have any actual users in the system using and engaging in the application. Well, then, you know, it's only a matter of time before that customer is going to go, or this isn't even working for us. So we surround those customers with, we have a whole group of people that we have that help customers realize value in those types of investments that they're making and that they're tracking along the way. And yeah, it really has to do with understanding business value and then making sure that the customer is able to deliver value. A good salesperson is able to kind of help manage that expectation internally. When is the customer ready for that? Because, you know, the cost of a sale for us is super high. You know, we have 100 people involved and it's literally millions of dollars that you're investing in a large sales motion for a customer. And so you have to make sure, you know, that customer is going to return that at some level. And if that doesn't happen and they get rid of the software, you know, you can oversell as the term like we like to use. A lot of, you know, I mean, when you have a strong brand and when customers, you know, are enamored with technology and all of that, then it's awesome. Oh, that's great. And it makes sometimes the sale a lot easier and not like that congressional, you know, testimony that we saw earlier this week. Sometimes it's just like, oh, we just love you. You're awesome. And, you know, you have people in the customer. This is another thing that's, I think, really interesting. Customers are, and you know this as a developer and working with developers, customers' careers are often like individuals. Like we say, it's teams of individuals. Now, if you're a quote-unquote Microsoft shop, that means your customers IT department is invested in their careers in your tech. And so if we go into a shop where there's Oracle there, you know, that chance of value where everybody is, you know, all Oracle certified, all of their, you know, dev work and consulting backgrounds, you know, they're all Oracle people. If you don't have a good story or aren't able to work with that, you know, and we're perceived as some sort of threat to that, you know, it's not good. It's not good for us. And it's not good for the customer either, because that means a lot of disruption is going to happen. Now, some companies, that's their strategy, actually. Yeah, there's that nuance that sometimes the customers have happy eyes, is what I like to call it. You know, they look at it and they're like, oh, that's the best thing ever. And we can just really do that. And they oversell that capability, our ability as a team to deliver that result. Sometimes you as a person, you know, as a team, have to kind of step back and go, this is not probably the right fit.
How do you massage that experience? So, I mean, what I mean by that is, like, you gave several examples of making sure that the customer essentially comes in, really understands the technology. In my mind, it's almost like, you know, sort of what I heard is, here are the features that are right for you, and this is how you navigate our technology. Because we have, you know, a bunch of things that can help you of sort of navigating through this space blindly. We understand you. We understand what you're trying to do. And here are the things that can help you. Here's the most efficient way to use our technology and onboard yourself. And so, well, let me understand the granularity of all your problems all the way down to solving some of the things that you want to get solved, right? So, and that has to happen among different departments, and especially for large companies and large deals, and departments and different skill sets and different people who've invested in that, right? But you're still going to always get a pushback. Going back to the original statement, sort of how do you massage that experience of on the customer side of being maybe a little bit hesitant and sort of whether you're, it's fine and dandy to have the solution, but it may not be as fine and dandy to have them try it and things of that nature. How do you massage the actual experience? Because you've sort of laid down the groundwork, spider web of all the places you need to make it happen. But then there's a one-on-one interaction where you're trying to encourage something. And in the cases that you spoke about last, for people who are particularly invested in not understanding it, right? They have a different skill set and another technology, something like Oracle, like you spoke about. So, you know, just to sort of summarize, like how do you make that happen? What is the one-on-one relationship you're building per individual? Maybe a person has this skill, and because of that, engage in this way. This person has this skill, because of that, engage in this way. Everybody has sort of their own jargon and the way they value in a conversation, right? Engineers are a bit more, is this or is this not working? What is the shortcut? And then the other skill sets a little bit more softer in their perception of information. And it's more about a sort of like emotional relationship and emotional labor to engage, right?
So, I mean, broadly, it's doing a really great job at discovery, right? So, I mean, the kind of classic, you know, application deployment or development 101, discover, design, develop, deploy kind of model, like that framework that's been around sort of since the 70s, you know, is really, in many ways, there's nuances to that with more modern and agile methodologies, but that's really a big part of it. What we train our sales teams actually to do, and that's part of my job actually, is to facilitate design thinking and human-centered design workshops. And we really focus in on persona mapping and designing based around that type of methodology. Like, what is the value? Put yourself in the mind and of an individual machine operator. Like, for example, we're working on, right now, I'm working on with a team that is trying to help encourage collaboration in a factory setting. So you have, you know, foremans and, you know, the first, when you think of factory, you think of the frontline, literally operator of a machine or the person assembling something. Their ability to realize the technology that is like, oh man, we can have teams and all of these kind of cool capabilities. But when you start looking at machine operator can't be distracted during the day, like they have to walk onto the shop floor and they're focused on that machine that they're operating or the job that they're doing. And so tech is a distraction for that person. So, you know, you start to understand that persona. And then, but then you go at the shift break, that's when they're going into the lunchroom and kind of picking up the culture of the day and like, what is a training program or available for me? My career path here, you know, am I always going to be a machine operator or can I go into supervision? What about other, I had a question about this other machine. Where do I put that question? And the company wants to build a culture. So maybe there's other experiences that that person can realize in the value of something like Microsoft Teams or a collaboration type of environment. And so at first, you know, developers are like, oh man, the operator, he really, or she really, man, they could really benefit from this. And you're, as we kind of discover more about that customer, not just a giant customer, it's a set of individuals there and using those personas to guide what ultimately in the sale we're looking for is that what is the value, the business value of this solution. And then mapping that to individuals that kind of persona-wise. I'm trying to understand the customer's environment and how the systems are working together really helps us then help build a program for the customer. And when I say program, let's say a project plan or a deployment kind of engagement model that then delivers on value. So they know kind of part of that. So we are a partner then with the customer, help them, you know, understand that, deliver, you know, we hire consultants externally that will get Microsoft sponsors and pays for those nine workshops. We have technology centers, we call MTCs, where customers, you know, in all over to a Microsoft office, and they spend days with, you know, solution architects and business value architects. We have economists, our business value specialists, that's all they do. They don't sell any software. Literally, they do those types of ethnographic studies to get into the individuals that are, you know, doing the work and what they do individually and what the business value of, like, man, if we help change that behavior, could get a little more productivity out of that person or that group of people. Or, you know, we're coming in with a point of view from our perspective that's often tailored to a particular customer. We start with an industry perspective often, and then it's nuanced because not every, you know, manufacturer is the same as, let's say, General Motors or something like that, just because they build something, you know, their business models are often so nuanced and different. So
I guess what is the reusability of this, right? You know, do you have to do that every single time?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, because that's the work that teams like mine are often doing, where we have industry specialists or we're looking for patterns. We have customer innovation, like our team, I'm on what we refer to as activation. I work on a team with business analysts, customer innovation specialists, and insight specialists, data scientists. What we're often trying to do, well, not often, every day, this is what our mission is try to come up with hypothesis of sales motions for the company, and then kind of trying to identify those repeatable, let's say, patterns of behavior that a customer may have, then try to come up with a solution play, can train our sales organization on to say, you know, this is a pattern, let's just use energy as a thing. So there right now is a big transition that's happening in the energy industry, right? Growth in the use of renewables, wind farms, solar, those types of things. And so now all of a sudden that kind of how those customers service management programs for those large, you know, farms and is very different. It's a new business generally. So at scale, how do you manage a 70, you know, ginormous, you know, windmills and wind generators? So to identify these industries and sub-industries or mega patterns industry, like, for example, something where manufacturers, companies are trying to have a low asset business model where we don't own any of the stuff. We just Uber-fy everything. Like, that's a certain pattern. So like when you walk into a customer and you see, oh, they're trying to Uber-fy, it's like, all right, I have a kind of a solution pattern then that says, all right, you need to have a portal and you need to have legal compliance across every state. You know, we know that's going to be a blocker. And so in some ways it's like, and that's why a lot of us on these teams have come from consulting. you know, because it's kind of a consulting almost model that you need to do to be able to do that. So yeah, we call them sales plays or solutions, well, patterns. And we have industry teams, and then we even nuance that more regionally, because manufacturing in Germany is very different than manufacturing, let's say, in India. The whole, you know, value.
I was going to ask you, how does that work across, I guess, because you talk a bit about ethnocentric sort of plays, and sort of like, how does this, because you have industry, you have, you know, granularity among industries, you have changes in industry, you know, relative to like, and then sort of like different degrees of ownership of, you know, sort of operations, right? So now you're talking how you do it across, across countries with, you know, maybe countries are nested, have nested sort of subcult, you know, everyone thinks every country is one thing, but it's every country is really like multiple cultures, multiple social class behaviors, and just a bunch. There's so much granularity in human groups. Then I guess my second question is like, how do you manage all this, all these intellectual models?
Yeah. So the first one is a really good question, because that is one of the kind of the secret sauces of a company like Microsoft, understanding and building understanding that the solution is consumed and valued differently in different countries and different regions. And so that model that we use for, let's say, automotive in Germany, that industry, let's say Mercedes, very different. I deploy that similar solution for service management country in a different country like India. And those are maybe two opposite sides, or China, two opposite sides where the labor value is different, right? So I may be a manufacturer, but if my manufacturer's individuals are super low skilled and highly abundant, the need to highly make people super productive or address turnover or something like that is very different. That calculus, that all of a sudden that business model that you had for selling something super high tech in an industry or in a market that where labor is super tight, then, you know, the kind of value proposition changes. So you have, and this is at least my philosophy coming at it from, you know, a sales perspective, having been a salesperson and trained salespeople for years and years, that you really have to trust your front line. You have to, you know, I work for a corporate team and we're here to support them. And so what you have is industry, you have, you know, in market people. Like we have 20 different regions at Microsoft. So the German team, they kind of take what we put together, and then we work with them individually, their leadership in Germany, to help shape that message and to do things over there. And then when we're over in, you know, Australia or, you know, Japan, it's totally different. Totally different. They'll take the same basic patterns, may emphasize one thing over another, you know. And so, you know, it's just work. That's part, you know, that's the work often, to kind of dial it in to different regions to, you know, support them. Yeah.
I think would be interesting to hear is, now that, you know, we have the whole COVID thing where people started working remotely, right? So the concept of like cultural integration is not different than it used to be. Like, you can immerse yourself in a completely different culture. Like, I mean, there's an degree of absoluteness that isn't true there. But if you have people on the ground and they're mostly working remotely, then you now have to start having people whose purpose is to absorb that culture a bit more. Do you need someone doing that? Or is that like, is that osmosis enough? Do you know what I mean? Or do you already have people whose job is already to do that? Like, you're here to sort of coach players entering into your market and how to behave. So how is that? Is that formally managed? Is that informal? It sounds more informally managed than formally managed, right? But now there's this shift in human interaction, like that surface area reducing. Has anything had to change? If not, that's probably great, right? But if it does, it's interesting to hear how.
So for us, when you look at the COVID impact on selling, it really had more to do with travel on job sites. Most of the sales organization at Microsoft works at home anyways. They're rarely going into the office. And that's not unique to Microsoft. I mean, salespeople generally are not productive in the office, generally speaking, unless there's some compelling benefit for them. You know, usually it's like, I remember when I was a sales director, I tried to model this behavior too. When I was a sales manager, I had to tell my guys and gals, guy, do not want to see you in the office. Go, you know, there's a reason you have an expensive account. Go take people out for lunch. Go, you know, go build relationships with people. And so, you know, if you're in the office, come in for a meeting or something like that, but you know, that's, you know, you're not being super productive when you're in the office. And what I would do from time to time, back in the day, it was cool to have what they don't even sell these things anymore, but conversion vans, they call them conversion vans, where you'd take like a big, like a Econoline van, like a 40 Econoline van, and you put carpet in it and had less, almost like a camper, you know, it's like a camper. Now we have like big Suburbans, but you didn't have those back then. So anyways, I had a conversion van and it was basically like a little mobile office. I had a desk in there and like I could chill out. I had a fridge and all of this stuff in my van. And I literally would park that in my lot at work in the back and nobody would know that. And so they would call on my cell phone and I would come into the office, but I was trying to show them like, you don't need to be in this building. Please don't be in the building. Pierre's not available. He's out right now. And he's out in the field. I really was sitting in the parking lot, in my van, doing work. I was just working in the van, but it's funny. We are people that are in market. Like I would say 80-90% of, you know, the people, let's say, for example, if I'm in Japan, we have a Japanese business unit with Japanese that live in Japan selling to Japanese customers. In China, same thing, Chinese employees in China selling to Chinese customers. So that you get that perspective naturally. Now, of course, to do whatever they want in terms of like, if I'm an American and I decide, hey, I want to go work in Italy. You know, then I could go apply for it. And so we have that. Certainly people move around, you know, and so we are super ethnically diverse. We do have certain, let's say, call centers speak for some of our cells where our entry level salespeople work on what we call digital sales, which is like outbound calling and lead generation. And some of those do exist, but they do exist in countries, so to speak, in different regions that. When I've trained, I did a big training program for those folks last year and audit, you know, and a bunch of them, let's say there's one we have in Dublin, Ireland, and we have people from all over the world that were young people that just out of college or just getting a job at Microsoft, and they would want to move to Dublin. That, you know, it's a super diverse group of people that are from all different ethnic backgrounds, all living in Dublin, you know, as a team. So it's interesting. But we try to have, you know, people are in market to give that perspective. Otherwise, it doesn't really work. It's not, that's the international sales, you know, you can't just take an American-centric group and try to just take that team and go sell in Pakistan, you know, and show up with, you know, I live in the Midwest in a very non-racially diverse area of the country. We don't have a lot of diversity here. And so I have had friends that have worked for some of the companies that are local here that have tried to do that. And, you know, when you go to India and you show up with, into Dutch people, you know, then that gives you a certain identity as a, you know, a Dutch company or something like that. And this is part of, you know, the push for the tech companies like us to try to make sure that our folks really understand the benefit and value of diversity. And it's not just like this kind of, you know, kind of woke liberal idea. It's like a business strategy. Like we need to be diverse because you've got to have that kind of all these different perspectives and that ability to be able to speak in the customer's not just physical, literal language and local, like French people in France that are businesses want to do business in French. They don't want to do business in American English. And it's just a cultural thing. And so it's just, you know, it's building empathy with one of the most important skills as a technical seller is if you picked it up is trying to build empathy. Like I want to listen and I want to understand the customer's viewpoint, what those individuals are, who they are, what they do, why are they motivated to do that work? And all of those things are very individualistic, and the values that those individuals have are different in Africa than they are in, you know, in Silicon Valley, and than they are in, you know, the pride of work and, you know, the reason you show up every day. Those are all different values that people have. So yeah, we have in country, to answer it more specifically, we have in country individuals that help the corporate organization reflect and nuance message in their market. So it
was a question for you specifically, like, how did you really get into technical sales? Like, what was your journey in this very niche? Because it's, you know, it's kind of like all sales are now kind of technical sales, regardless of, it's relative whether or not you want the title really now. But basically, all sales at any level, at any most tiers, is really, you know, kind of this product's technical ability or technical augmentation is better than the other one, or is now present where it wasn't already. Right, cars now are really just computers on wheels, and more so.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, there, you know, tech ends up being a large nuance or a large part of a lot of sales. Like, unless you're selling, well, there's not much that you can sell anymore. Maybe healthcare, insurance, or something like that. But so I sold my first computer in 1989, and it was a company similar to Best Buy. It was a local computer, an appliance store. And I got really interested in computers when I was driving a Hilo and working in a warehouse after college. And a guy showed up to our place, and we were an automotive supplier. And this warehouse that I worked in, they needed to have a connectivity because we had to connect to General Motors every day. And so we set up a computer there in the office. And so this is like 86. So it's an old IBM, you know, PC, very traditional, you know, $2,000-$3,000, you know, 8 megahertz computer with a, you know, probably a 10 megabyte hard drive or something like that, you know, in a color, not a color monitor, you know, like a green monitor. And it was to send what's called advanced shipping notices to General Motors to say, this is what we're shipping to you today. And here's the boxes that you're going to get and the serial numbers and all that. So this guy had a travel from Detroit, which is like 3 hours. He shows up in a fancy Volvo, and he took like, I don't know, 15 minutes to install this fancy schmancy modem. And I had the purchase order because I had a sign off. So I was the guy that was there. And I'm like looking at this invoice, and this guy charged like $2,000 to install this. And the modem that he put in, which was like by today's standards, a joke, you know, like it was literally a 1200 baud modem, which is like ancient, like these are the very first modems, and it's so slow. You can't even imagine how slow this is compared to what we're dealing with today. And I was like, I'm just intrigued by this guy showed up here and just made $2,000. Like, how does this work? And I just grilled the guy for it because it was just him and me. And I'm like, that is the career for me. I need to figure out how to get into that, you know, because I was just courting my wife and we were just like, I'm going to start a family soon. I, you know, driving Hilo is awesome, fun job. If I could do that and get paid what I get paid, I would do that. Believe me, that was a lot of fun. I love that job. So that was my inspiration. I literally bought a book, How to Become a Computer Consultant. And it was one of these, like, getting that vision for, I think I could do this. I think I could do this. I'd already understood the value of computers in high school. We had, you know, just back in the late 70s, I did take, believe it or not, I took a, you have like a high school, like trade school thing that you can do, these like trade schools now. And so I actually went to the skill center, they called it, and at half my day, you know, learning data processing. And this was like literally card punch machines and machine and back. And the thing, you're trying to get your computer students not to become programmers, like they called them operators, which literally was physically cleaning the machines and how they, you know, changing the tapes and all of this. It was a very kind of physical, mechanical component, and that I just hated it. I just didn't get it. I didn't like it. And I just failed at being successful at that. And so, but I did figure out, and anyway, so I was able to start. Yeah, I had that vision, and I was very persistent at. So I'm like, okay, the first place I can do is go sell computers. So I did. I found a job at Highland Superstores, and which was, like I said, a Best Buy, and we sold computers, and I got paid pretty good. You know, back in the day, computers were like $3,000 for a home computer. And you got paid a couple $100 for everyone you sold as commission. And so, you know, you learn the thing, you know, you don't sell. And so it was really interesting. And so then I had a transition into some sort of business sales. And that was a hard kind of transition for me to try to go from selling computers at a retail store to selling, you know, computers into a business environment and trying to find opportunities there. But I was able to do that. I became what they called an inside salesperson then, which is the individual that I had one customer. I was basically working with their purchasing department at a large national bank, a big bank. And then, just kind of in the right place at the right time, because at that time, not realizing, you know, their companies are transitioning from mainframe computers to PCs on the desktop. And that whole, you know, early 90s motion, you know, put me right in the right spot, working with the right kind of bank that was literally buying, you know, 300 computers a week and trying to get them installed, you know, for the next 3 years. And just, I learned so much by just the grunt work of, you know, going buying computers and selling them for, you know, just figuring out how to do it and stuff like that. So, you know, slowly but surely. Yeah.
No, how were you able to get that relationship with that bank? That must have been extremely impossible.
Well, it was through a distributor, right? So then, you know, so there was a company that today they're like companies like Ingram and Tech Data. So it was a company back then called Inicom. And Inicom was a early company that was in that business. They were a cost plus type of company. And so we had opportunities in Michigan, and I just found that company just through literally, you know, reading ads in papers and sending applications out and trying to network and stuff like that. And that one came as an opportunity to be a grunt salesperson, and, you know, just to no commission at all, just learning the business. And that was just as an inside salesperson back then. You had it was similar to sales engineering. Honestly, you had an account sales rep that would go out and sell the stuff, and then he would give you literally a paper order, and then you'd have to go. I'd have to go on my computer and then like go shop for all of those things that the company needed, you know, buying a couple hundred computers and then getting them logistically put in at, you know, delivered to a bank branch or some sort of data center or something like that. And then coordinating with the team. So it was just one of those things. I think anybody that wants to get into technical sales, you have to really be grounded in the back part of that. So that involved installing computers, that involved setting them up. My retail experience was setting up computers. Often we would unbox them for customers. You know, back then it was just, here's your box. And so what our little group did is we took over part of the store, and we actually had a little computer center there. And so we would set the computers up for the customers before they left. And, you know, we added extra value, we put menus in there. And so this is before Windows was actually even a thing, believe it or not. 89, you know, Windows was just coming out, like, woohoo, that was awesome. You're literally building menus, and the customers had like three computer programs, like the word processor and a game. And if you're going to get into technical sales, part of it is being technical. You have to have that grounded, you know, if somebody's technical selling in, let's say, valves, you know, high pressure valves, you know, somebody that's doing that business generally is an engineer first, or knows that business really, really well. I have a customer that they have a high, they sell an engineer to order product. And yeah, they hire engineers and make them salespeople. So usually you have to have a passion for the tech. Like that's part of like that you're just a nerd over that stuff. And then the rest of the stuff becomes kind of natural, because you kind of have this enthusiasm already. And that was me. I was very enthusiastic over, you know, computers and stuff like that. I really had a passion.
No, that's actually fantastic. So a few questions I still haven't asked you. One of them is, I guess you talked about different industries, and, you know, here's this industry that does this and this industry that does that. and some of the differences between selling for different industries. I think you spoke more about different kinds of people, but like for different industries, like sort of what are the different ways in which like you sort of sell for them or engage them in their technology? Because you talked about wind farms and what it's like to you know, sell for that group versus selling an automotive factory. And if an automotive factory has, you know, stopping business for them, but maybe for a company that, you know, like a wind farm, I guess you kind of don't really stop, but it's just like working for the people who manage them, I suppose. So if you can expand on that experience, like working for the different, working with different industries, what that's really like on a more sort of more granular level.
So that when I was started at Microsoft, that was my initial role was we called them global black belt. So like a ninja kind of black belt kind of a person. So anyways, we had that sales engineering experience. You're basically building demos and getting into the, you know, you're part of that team that's actually going in and doing the work of building. It's like a consulting project, you know, because you're building that proof stage. So you own that. I owned that proof stage basically for lots of different opportunities. So that was so much fun because, yeah, every day, you know, you would be working on different industries, whether that was, so I had a long stint where I did energy. So I just did oil and gas customers like the Chevrons and Exxons of the world. So down to Texas every couple weeks and down into the Houston office. We talked about our MTCs, our technology centers, going into that and doing demos and doing discovery workshops and stuff like that, learning all about the business. Like, so this is from a technical sales, this is the, let's say, drug, if you will, of that is the learning of those industries and just kind of just getting into the meat and potatoes of, you know, what their operations are, learning their language and all of that. And so then you build, I was able to, after about a year and a half of working on that one industry, I was able to produce an industry, what we refer to as a reference architecture. And those are those kind of slides you see Microsoft and everybody that's to produce a, like these are the different layers of the application solution and how, you know, for your industry, this is that perspective that Microsoft is starting with. And that becomes we call those called reference architectures. A reference architecture. Yeah. A reference architecture says, you know, like for, if you're in the oil production business and you have oil wells out there, you have to manage a fleet of equipment out there, you know, so we figured out all of the different jobs that are there on the job site and what's the whole, how do they dispatch the different people and how do the vendors that they hire that come out and let's say deliver water or cement, you know, to the job site, how is that all done and coordinated? So you get the perspective of the industry and then you start to kind of understand, you know, what the underlying IT capabilities you need to support those different business values, you know, so, you know, they have subtle nuances. And so like, and so that oil and gas, so that was like a big feather in my cap that I like, woohoo, we got to. So the reference architecture was published and then there's a demo that now becomes the demo that all the MTCs around the world can work on. They just now can turn your demo on. And so I had that demo for how to do scheduling for maintenance for, you know, that industry. And so you learn all about that. And then a year later, I moved on to just to doing heavy equipment manufacturers. So large companies, like we just had a big announcement with John Deere recently. We have a dealer program for them and how their dealers are going to leverage a Microsoft solution. Well, that was just announced like this around December. I finally can talk about it. I pitched that solution back in 2018. Like this is how long it takes sometimes for those things to develop. So same thing, you know, you go out there to their different locations of business and you kind of just do all that work and present a reference architecture and help them pull together the technical solution, try it out in a couple of places, get the partners in there, lots of meetings, lots of stuff back and forth, you know, with different organization parts of the organization to kind of pull everything together. And then, you know, and then the development phase, it took a, you know, a quite a period of time for them to kind of build it. And now launching it, they just are launching it now. And so then, you know, so I got to learn all about the industry, which I love, which is the heavy equipment manufacturers. Being in the Midwest, it's just amazing. You know, some of the customers that you'll see on our reference account, like Caterpillar International, Komatsu, you know, these are all within 150 miles of where I live. You know, that's pretty, really interesting. Like, why? Who knows? It's just the, you know, this is the legacy of Henry Ford, or why, you know, being on the Mississippi River, or whatever, you know, made this this kind of industries all like spin up here. But like when you go to the Komatsu factory, makes these ginormous like cranes and road graders, you pass right by a Caterpillar factory. Like they're like literally within, you know, like. So it's like Detroit somehow became, you know, Ford and General Motors, or Pittsburgh is where all the steel companies are. Like, it's just really interesting of the, in the Midwest, we see these heavy industries.
You talked about, and then, you know, with regards to some of the passions you have for, you know, working with people who are really at the sort of like ground and on the frontier of building things and, you know, sort of contributing to society with their skill sets. That, you know, usually, I guess in your case, really working with your hands or building really big machines, and the sort of the experience of having that technology move over into other areas, I guess, in the world as a consequence of globalization. And to some degree, you know, globalization is really a derivative of network technologies becoming more powerful. So I think that big wave that you experience and sort of the outcome of your career as a consequence of that. I think that rotation has the opportunity to happen again, maybe in a different way, with some of the new technologies like the ChatGPT or just machine learning in general. And a lot of people are nervous. I actually saw, you know, I watched a video of a lady who's been an artist for a decent amount of years, and some of what ChatGPT is able to do in a second can be a little bit debilitating for her skill set. And she was sort of talking about that and sort of there are pros and cons to that. You know, at the end of the day, technology has to move forward. We can't be Luddites, but there is a real effect there. So I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on, you know, it's interesting what sector it now affects. It's sort of like the snake is eating its own tail a little bit. You know, sort of technology is accelerating up the ladder of skill sets. So it's interesting to see what it's eaten up. And it'd be great to hear what you think about that, because I guess you're seeing something happen again and seeing how people are reacting versus how people reacted then. And, you know, are there similarities, are there differences? And since you've seen it before, you're probably seeing something else from it too, right?
It's a interesting time, put it this way. I'll talk about it from two perspectives. First is maybe a framework. I think that I'll give you the perspective first and then maybe talk about some of the specific examples of how you apply that perspective. Because what I have learned, you know, as an old dude now, having, you know, witnessed all of this stuff, changing people's lives and impact, is it's a very simple solution. And it's encapsulated in a book, Who Moved My Cheese? I don't know. It's kind of a there's a book called Who Moved My Cheese, and it's by Stephen Covey. He's the guy that wrote Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And so it's a very simple little book, but it tells a story of rats in a maze trying to find the cheese. And the cheese moves, and everybody has different responses to when things change. And so his advice there is move with the cheese. You know, if you keep inspecting the cheese all the time, where that value is, what that source of your happiness, if you will, is, or your source of sustenance, whether that's a job or, you know, even in relationships. And actually, he wrote it because he was getting divorced, and he wanted to come up with some sort of tale for his kids that, hey, things are different, and give them some strategies. And anyways, you have different characters, and some of them are like, oh, despondent, the cheese has moved. Why did the cheese move? And, you know, trying to understand all of the societal impacts. And we certainly see that happening today, where people are just, you know, it's that TikTok in front of Congress, where it's just like, dude, the cheese has moved. You like young people are socializing in a different way than you did. Okay. And they don't feel this as a threat. And somehow you're thinking this is a threat. This is sounds like, you know, people watching Elvis Presley's hips, you know, or rock and roll or hip hop, like that's not real music. And, you know, you guys, you kids, young kids today don't know what you're doing. And it's like, you know, that's kind of like what happens with a lot of this. Like you said, there's a certain level of inevitability, like the tech is going to eat itself because it is there's no conspiracy, like somebody's in charge of it. It is it's going to find value, and then people vote with their dollars and attention. And so unless you can somehow interrupt that, you know, you're just standing in the middle of the train track, you know, that line in The Matrix where Agent Smith holds Neo's head to the train tracks and he's like, you know what that is? That is the sound of inevitability. And it's like, that's what this kind of these moments are.
Well, speaking about voting with your dollars and your attention, where can people find you?
Well, for me, like I said, I have a kind of a thought experiment that I'm doing. It's called thetechnicalseller.com. And that is a podcast that I'm starting. And I'm trying, you know, it's a side hustle. So I'm trying to do my best on trying to be super consistent with it. I've got, I think, about 30 episodes in there. And we've morphed it a little over the year and a year and a half or so that I've been working on it. So yeah, we're just going to continue that kind of conversation. I'm just really fascinated with what are the skill sets that somebody that's either starting in sales or somebody like yourself that's in an organization that's very driven by, like, we don't maybe have dedicated sellers. You know, we don't have a lot of resources just to go do sales. We're going to take our people and do sales. So if I'm an entrepreneur or a small business, you know, I basically have to figure out how to sell now and run my business at the same time.
Well, Pierre, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it, you know.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Thank you. Anytime.